Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have a really exciting young man, Achintya Anand from Krishi Kress. Achintya, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
Achintya is a Cordon Bleu from Adelaide. He is from the International Culinary Center in New York. And interestingly, he grows microgreens and unconventional vegetables. And he's moving up the value chain. Achintya, tell me, what are microgreens?
So basically, microgreens are any plant that is harvested at a stage of its first two leaves. Mm. So basically, mustards, radish, beetroots, sunflowers, all these plants, when they're sown, they are at a stage where they only have two leaves. Mm. So once when we harvest them at that stage and consume them, that's what we call microgreens. They are nutritionally dense. And they have a lot more flavor than the mature sort of counterparts.
Okay.
So that's how what microgreens are. And other than the nutritional aspect, they've become like a thing that the chefs are using to garnish on their plates and sort of add aesthetic value to their food.
So you mean if you harvest a vegetable early, it has better nutrition as compared to a fully matured?
See, the thing is, if you take it quantity for quantity, it does.
Hmm.
Like if you take 40 grams of microgreen and 40 of red cabbage and 40 grams of mature red cabbage, 40 grams of microgreens is more nutrient dense.
Okay.
But then again, you don't end up consuming 40 grams of microgreens in one go.
Hmm.
So that's okay. Also there.
I see. Okay. Interesting. And then you also cultivate edible flowers.
Yes.
What are edible flowers? I mean, I know, remember as a child, we used to eat rose petals.
So exactly, a lot of the flowers that we are around or are even grown as ornamental are edible. We are aware of some of the flowers such as say hibiscus, chamomile that are more commonly consumed in teas.
Mm.
But there are other flowers like dianthus, nasturtiums, even the jasmines, your everyday flowers that you find around your complex. They're edible. They have different nutritional values. Some have anti-inflammatory, some are rich in antioxidants. And they've been used in food for ages, but sort of they've made a comeback over the past few years where they're being used again as a thing that the chefs use to add aesthetic value to their food.
So tell me, very interesting. I mean, you know, microgreens, edible flowers, you by training are a chef.
Yes, sir.
What made you make this incredible switch?
Sir, So I trained I went to do restaurant management in Australia. While I was doing that, I was like, I want to be on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So I went for this culinary course in New York and came back to the kitchen. And after doing the front of house and the back of house, I decided I don't want to do either.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into farming, which was basically by mistake, to be very honest. I was working at this restaurant called Tress in Lodhi Road.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was there, I was working as a chef and I wanted some sort of side hobby or additional pocket money. So I started playing around. I made some gulakand. I made some different type of sausages. Someone told me I wanted to try microgreens. So I just sort of told my Mali that this is what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do it. And he did it and it came out really nice. And I went around Delhi saying I'm a supplier all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it sort of caught on. And that's how I started moving into microgreens, edible flowers.
Wow. And no plans to get back into a restaurant which now focuses on microgreens and flowers?
Sir, not into a restaurant concept per se, but definitely I would like to have sort of brunches or dinners or people come in and eat and experience produce that's so fresh and being grown where you're pretty much eating. That sort of a concept is something that I do have at the back of my mind.
Okay. Very interesting. I mean, this is such a fascinating kind of sphere that you are in. And the biggest advantage I find when I talk to so many millennials like you is that I learn something new every time. And so then now the next learning for me. I was reading about kombucha and you. What is kombucha?
So kombucha is this sort of probiotic drink.
Mm-hmm.
It is basically three ingredients, tea, water, and sugar, which are fermented. And it's been around for ages, for years and years and years. If you ask me for the origin, the Russians had a document which claimed it to be Kargosok tea. Japanese have it in their culture. And obviously Americans claim it's theirs. Okay. So it's been there for ages. What it does is it's a probiotic. Okay. There are many different health benefits associated to it. Immunity, metabolism, digestion. But as they say that, you know, if your stomach is good, everything else becomes good. So the main thing is your digestive system being a probiotic. That's what kombucha is. Okay.
And, you know, probiotic to the common person is basically yogurt.
Right.
Now, this is something new. What exactly does it do, which is different, or is it similar to dahi?
It is actually very similar to probiotics. It's like any other probiotic. Mm. So if someone asks me that if I don't want to have kombucha and I want to have dahi or yogurt or some other kind of probiotic, should I have that? I'd say yes. Mm. It's just another sort of type of probiotic that you can add to your diet.
Correct. And where does one get kombucha?
So actually, so we are supplying kombucha at Blue Tokai, mm-hmm. And we are doing home deliveries, and we've tied up with a few restaurants in Delhi and NCR that we are.
So you supply a
ready to drink okay. Beverage, and other than that, if someone wants to drink it regularly, there's a sort of a subscription model that mm-hmm. we offer. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's also really easy to brew yourself. So we also encourage that you can get a Scooby, brew it yourself. It becomes more of a hobby also. So that those are some of the ways that one can get into that.
Wow. Wow. And then the next question, I mean, you know, I've learned about microgreens, I've learned about edible flowers, and I've learned about kombucha. And then you have something called unconventional vegetables. What are these?
So by unconventional vegetables, what I meant is that like we have beetroots which are of three colors. So you usually get the red one. We grow golden, white, there's a candy stripe. I have about 8 or 9 colors of radishes growing at my farm right now.
Wow.
So there'll be like a purple radish, a pink radish. So those kind of vegetables, what I could call unconventional.
And do you engineer these vegetables, or are these naturally?
These are natural varieties. Actually, what has happened due to what is acceptable in the market, these varieties are not being cultivated that much, and it's been narrowed down to what is actually working at a very large scale, and things that are not so like pest resistance have been left behind. So these are naturally occurring varieties that are out there. There are cauliflowers that are purple in color, and they're naturally purple in color. They're rich in antioxidant. Even carrots. In India, we have used to black carrots. Correct. There's a drink called kanji, which is again a probiotic. Yeah. So those are not engineered. Those are varieties that have not been sort of marketed or accepted widely.
Mm. What I find very interesting is that things that my mother and my grandmother used to make, like a kanji or, you know, even purple cabbage, etc. Those all seem to be coming back. Why do you think that is happening?
So that's very true. What happens is even moringa is something that has been with us in India forever. There was an article that someone showed me where the government said that there are two trees that every Indian household must have is kadi patta and moringa. But what happens is still the Western culture sort of talks about it. That sort of colonial mentality sadly is still there, where we hear that it's good, doing good, or it's on Oprah Winfrey, quinoa, this, that. And then we come back and realize, okay, this is what we have.
Yeah.
And that's sadly the sort of cycle that of appreciation.
That is so true. Even something like you know, psyllium husk or isabgol is now being imported, refined, and being sold at horrendous prices in India.
The other day I saw some American company marketing a neem toothbrush.
I know.
So it's funny, like how it's going around, and then we are like, okay, the Americans or the Western world is doing it, so we should.
So therefore, we should do it. I agree with you. Very, very interesting. So you know, all the things that you are growing are in organic farms, and a lot of our viewers and listeners have farms or are interested. What are the first steps that need to be taken to be able to develop an organic farm more so given all the messing up we have done with our land.
So, sir, one thing that Krishi Kress and I, like, we stay away from the term organic per se. Because when I started farming, I blindly sort of said organic. 5 years into it, I'm realizing what is actually organic and how everyone has their own interpretation of what organic is. So that's been a learning. For me, my standard is we don't use chemicals and we sell what we eat.
I see.
That's where we come in. For someone looking to start farming, see, that's where I sort of get into this thing that organic is by the rich and for the rich, because there have been talks about leaving the land barren for 3 years, 5 years. You and I can afford it. You think a normal farmer can afford leaving his land barren for 4 or 5 years?
Correct.
They can't.
Yeah.
So, other than that, there are other ways of doing it. There's green manuring that you can grow certain crops that add nitrogen, fixing crops and other things that add to the soil rather than taking away from it. Those are some of the ways. Otherwise, you know, so a soil test and a water test is the simplest way to start. Honestly, what my advice would be, don't overthink it. Like, if you see that there has been, like, if you go to a piece of land and you see there's a healthy crop, the Mali or whoever is staying there has been growing it, take it slowly, slowly, work with that land. Don't overthink too much that what is the pH, what is this, that. Because if you're suppose going into a cultivation, suppose I'm saying I'll take 10 acres, I'll plant olives. Then I need to do all my research, because then it becomes a proper business. If I'm saying I have a land lying in Gurgaon, half an acre, I want sabji to come for my house, just start.
Okay. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. And, you know, you also mentioned that correct nutrition is very critical for our bodies. And yet, most of us eat wrong foods. Have you outlined any step-by-step approach to eating correctly, or what are your thoughts?
See, I personally feel that I'm no one to tell anyone, because everyone's body type and what they're used to or what their body needs is so different. But in today's world, anyone who's marketing a food item, if I'm marketing kombucha, I'll tell you, you drink kombucha, that's the elixir of life, that's all you need. Someone marketing a Nutri bar will say, and that ends up confusing the consumer.
Correct.
I would say there are a few basic guidelines that one can follow. And one of my basic answers to that, which you've already mentioned, is eat what your grandparents ate. If you eat what your grandparents and parents ate, you're probably going down the right track. Other than that, eat more veg. Don't, you know, have excess of anything, meat or any type of fat. Like, there needs to be a balance in your diet. But again, everyone's body type, where you live, a lot of us end up eating gajar, gobi all year round. Whereas it's not something that we should eat, like in summers. There's a reason why we are growing cucumbers and tomatoes, kheera, because they're water rich crops and our body needs water. Whereas in the winters, these root crops have heat in them, and that's why we eat them. So if you follow a certain basic guideline and eat what your grandparents or parents ate, I think you'll be down the right line.
That's a such sensible advice. Eat what your grandparents or your parents ate. Very interesting. So, you know, let's move to the next part of Krishi Kress, which is, you know, your work. You spoke about moving up the value chain with your post-harvesting unit and your branding. And just before we started this interview, you were saying that you are doing a lot of deliveries to various homes in and around the NCR. Talk to us a little bit about what steps you are taking to move up the value chain. What kind of equipment are you setting up?
So, sir, I've been lucky enough to be guided. The first thing that I started focusing on was post-harvest handling. I'm of the belief that product in our country, in the fields, is as good as anywhere in the world.
Correct.
It is when it's harvested and the handling happens is when it deteriorates. Abroad, it would be harvested, maybe even packed in the field itself, moved into the right temperature and handled thereon. Over here, it goes into gunny bags. Then it goes into the mandi. Then it'll lie there. Then it'll be transported and it'll come. That's why when you get mooli, you don't end up eating mooli ka patta because it's been so many ups and downs since it's come from the mandi to you. Otherwise, in the good old days, everyone used to have mooli ka patta with the mooli because it helps
Correct.
Digest the root and it is more nutritious than the root.
Correct.
So I think one thing that we tried to focus on was a post-harvest handling. I made the first sort of investment I made was a cold storage. And the first book I was given to read was the USDA guideline on post-harvest handling, which writes down how to handle every product, what temperature to be kept at. So I think that's following that and ensuring that what our customer gets, suppose if you get a salad from us, about 98 to 99% of that is usable. You don't have to grade it further. Plus, if you keep it in the fridge, it should last you 6-7 days. The shelf life is not absorbed during our harvest to getting it to you. The shelf life is at your end. So those are some of the things that sort of we focused on in adding value.
Okay. And you spoke of cold storage. Now, you know, cold storage facilities are very, very poor in our country. Do you think that in and around the NCR, and of course we don't know about the whole country, but is cold storage or are cold storage facilities beginning to get much more, or we're still at the same old stage?
So to be very frank, I'm not cultivating at that scale where I go into cold storage that are being rented at a mass level.
Okay.
Like there are people who are in the cold storage businesses. I've not been in touch with them. My business is still small enough to be able to use my own cold storages. So I don't really know about that right now.
And what are your plans for scaling up?
So honestly, I believe I've been doing this for 5 years. I don't believe I've been doing business for 5 years. And my mentor scolds me the same way that you've been a wheeler dealer. So I think these 5 years I've been learning and I've managed to touch wood, make some capital while learning. I'm honestly contemplating about how to grow this business, which way, should it be more B2B, should it be more B2C? And I don't have answers right now on which way I want to go down, but I'm sort of wetting my hands in different things and seeing what sort of opportunity lies. We've been able to capture a decent market, but I'm still trying to figure out how to scale up.
Okay. Well, maybe you and I should sit and chat sometime.
Yeah, I could use all the help.
I'm more than happy to help. So let's move to your experience as an entrepreneur. I mean, you know, you said 5 years as a young startup entrepreneur. Are you alone or do you have a partner?
Sir, I am alone right now.
Okay. And, you know, based on the last 5 years, what are some of your key learnings?
Sir, one, I think a few learnings. One is obviously focusing on the product. And I think one of the main key learning that I've had, because I've been sort of scolded into it, is not trying to appear big. I think a lot of startups try and project success before being successful. And that's one of the main things. The other thing would be that focusing on product in a way that having your product not easily imitable.
Okay.
Having a unique selling proposition that in the long term will sort of hold you in a good position rather than small term advantages. So that's what I've been learning in my few years.
No, I would agree with what you're saying. You know, I think one must never project something you're not.
Yes.
Because that's when you come across to your customer and to your investor as someone, as a genuine individual who needs all the help to grow. It's fascinating. So let's move on to a little bit about you personally. You know, a couple of times you've spoken about a mentor. What have been your key learnings from your mentor?
So my mentor is an 84-year-old gentleman. His name is Commodore Ajay Kumar Sani. I've learned everything about kombucha and agriculture from him. He's been brewing kombucha for 30 years.
Wow.
And he's been farming for the same. Very, very short-tempered. Has his own way of teaching. So So I'll give you a small example. Every morning, 5:30, 6 o'clock, for the past 3 years, I get a call saying, what's your plan?
Wow. And you're up at that early?
Yeah. Okay. And I started realizing during the initial calls, I didn't have a plan. And that's when I started to plan my days. Otherwise, what would come to my mind, okay, this is the first call that I've received from work that this needs to be run, I'll run in that direction. Next call, I'll run in that direction. So he's taught me that the importance of planning, that I need to plan my days, plan my weeks, have set targets as opposed to running in the direction of where the fire is every day, because there are fires everywhere. So I think that's been one of the major learnings from him. Other than that, he's been very focused on having a good product and building a good relation with your customers, understanding them. And he has a very old school way, which I love. What I say is dhanda. That's how he's taught me. So that's some of the key learnings that I would have from him.
Yeah. That's fascinating because, you know, my father used to be a very senior army person and your mentor is an Air Force person. Yeah. And, you know, they have their own style. And you said he's 84. My father would have been 92 by now. But I didn't, I'm much, much older than you are. But I think most of my learnings came from my father.
Yeah.
So what you're getting from your mentor is absolutely incredible.
You know, they have their own sort of some sayings that he'll have, ABC analysis, and he'll have his examples of doctors in the hospital that the patient would come and you need to. So he has his own way of going about it.
Wonderful. You should be consider yourself blessed, absolutely.
I am.
Have a mentor like him.
I am.
That's amazing. So tell me, you know, you've been a chef, you've been on the other side, now you become a gentleman farmer, wanting to scale up, successful. You said you'd be able to build some capital. How would you define some of your own strengths?
So my mentor first said to me, the only thing good about me, he said, the only thing good about me is tenacity.
Okay.
So that's one thing that I would say is there.
Okay.
Hands-on approach. I've literally like worked the land myself initially because I need to know what I'm asking someone else to do. I need to know how to sow the seeds, what the distribution of the seed should be. All these things I've learned while living at the farm and being up with the labor at the time, like at the time of sunrise, being there when they leave and doing your other work in the middle. That's hands-on approach, at least for these 5 years, has helped me a lot. And the next would be, I think, the product knowledge. Having, knowing your product in and out helps, because, and that's where the chef aspect sort of helps. Because I didn't really end up spending a lot of time in the kitchen after studying as a chef. And you really become a chef once you spend a few years in the kitchen. But what that sort of course and a little exposure helped me do is understand chefs. What they need, what kind of product they need. And I think that's really helped me tap into that market.
Interesting. Amazing. So tell me, you know, based on a very short 5 year career and you're so young, there must have been some failures. What have been some of your learnings?
So one of the initial sort of failure that I had was when I got a market which I was catering to. As any young person, I tried to do too much and things that were not in my control. So I met someone who was supplying some fish from Andaman and I was like, oh, there's potential money to be made here. And I started buying fish and working with him. But I had no control on the back end.
Correct.
I had no knowledge of the product, of what fish it is, what temperature it should be kept at, how it is to be used. And I sort of burnt my hands with that, with the chefs also who I'm supplying to. And at the back end also. So I think that was one of the major failures that made me realize that I will only get into things where I have the back-end production under my control or is with someone who I can really trust and I should have the product knowledge. That's been one of the biggest learning, and not overcommitting, because when you go to a chef, they'll ask you for the moon. And earlier when I would go, like, yes, you'll have this. And that's when my mentor taught me that don't try and sell what the chef is asking. Don't only try and sell what the chef is asking for, but sell what you have. Try and sell what you have. That's been something that I have learned, that I see what I have growing at the farm and try and sell that to the chef. Because chefs will have different requirements, which I can go around the moon looking for.
Correct.
But then that doesn't become my core strength.
True.
So that's been one of the major learnings, that sell what you have.
Mm. Very interesting. How big is your farm?
So, sir, it's very small. It's about 2 acres in Chhatarpur.
Okay.
But again, we have done a lot of intercropping. Mm. So from that 2 acres, we can get around 3, 3.5, if not 4 acres of product out. Other than that, this year only I've rented a 5-acre farm in Faridabad. So, yeah, so about
7 acres.
And then we work with other farmers who specialize in things that we rather not get into, like mushrooms, because it requires a different setup. Tomatoes and peppers, they require greenhouses. So we sort of focus on things that we can work on. And if there are farmers who are good at what they do, we try and work with them.
Okay. So one more question, which is, when was the last time you did something for the first time?
So the last time was actually very recently. I decided to sort of start saving money into some sort of investment or something. And I had never done that before. So I started reading the Financial Times, ET. I had no understanding. I just knew there's this thing called mutual funds. Mm-hmm. And then I would go on Money Control or all these websites and just look at random terms, FFI, DII, and just Google what it is. And just did that for about 6 months and then made my sort of first saving.
Wonderful.
So that was the first time I did. And now that sort of interest has continued. I keep reading, trying to understand.
Terrific. That's really very interesting. So my last question to you, a lot of young people who are watching, we are watched by close to 500 or 600,000 people every month. A lot of young people like you will watch this. And what they want to know from all my guests, is there any advice that you have to someone who's 20, 21 years old, starting out as an entrepreneur like you did?
I'll say there are a few things that I would have to say. Is one, focus on your product and focus on something that will be differentiating you in the long term. Because sooner or later, you might feel like you're a genius in this idea, but there will be people who will come in, match even the quality and maybe even cut you on pricing. So have a product that can stand the long haul. Second, again, don't try and project yourself.
Something you're not.
And focus on that. And I feel you should be hands-on and know every aspect of your business. When you are an entrepreneur, you become a part lawyer, a part doctor, a part everything. Because if my employees get sick, I'm taking care of them.
Correct.
Especially the labor staff. If there's a legal issue, I learn about that. If there's some tax, this thing, I learn about that. So you have to be open to learning all different aspects. It's rare that you just say that, okay, this is my specialty and I'll focus on that. So that's some of the things that I would say.
So Achintya, thank you very much. I think, you've given some amazing learning, certainly to me and to lots of our listeners. I wish you lots of success and I wish and hope to see Krishi Kress all over the country.
Thank you. Good luck to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.